Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
You survived the holiday radio show rehearsal, which is always, we should have t-shirts that say,
no, we should.
We survived the Cam Wicks radio show rehearsal. It's not the radio show itself. And poor Amy Markscores, her first rehearsal this morning, you know, becoming the victim of Kevin Colleen's tyrannical direction, right?
And let me see, who else were first-timers? Tom Ackerman's two children, one of whom's
a lot of kids in the show, right?
Birthday is today.
That's right.
Along with my son and...
Oh, your son's in it too?
No, birthday.
Oh, your birthday.
Birthday.
I'm sorry,
his birthday.
Sorry.
And Alex Ferrario isn't. No, this isn't his first one, is it?
I don't think it is.
He might have been in it before,
right?
But he has a more dramatic role.
Oh,
this
I didn't
time.
Know that. I didn't know
it's
that.
It's a much more dramatic role than have you. You didn't read the whole.
did I read the? Wait a second. Did you just ask me whole thing?
Yes, I did. You know what? This is the first time I probably read 95% of it. I skimmed, because you know what we do. We look for our name.
All right. I was looking for my sound effect, but everything is, you know, wait, here it is. Yeah. Everything's discombobulated because we have a new system.
We're learning. So that's your response to,
no,
did you read the script?
I have no idea what it's about. I just know the parts that I have to read. Yeah. You know, what we did in the rehearsal, you know, we jump around.
Yeah, we do. We
because,
never.
Since I had to be on the air, well, you know, it's
got
the logistics
to you early.
Of those people who have to work.
Yeah.
And we got to those scenes early, but I have no idea what happens in the beginning part of the show. So I'll be there watching along with everyone else.
Well, can I give you, if you want a synopsis, and I will make this so quick.
Oh, absolutely.
Dementia.
It's about dementia.
Maybe even Alzheimer's. But it is.
Yeah, but
and
I mean,
the truth of it, and Kevin told us this, Alex Degman and I, a couple of weeks ago in Afternoon Drive, he came in live at about 5:30 in the news, and I asked him, what was your inspiration? And he said, and he said this on the air, so I'm not saying anything out of school. And he said that once his father, who's now passed away, that he's been gone for, I want to say 10 years now, but his father was out driving with Kevin's sister's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And they get home, and his father said to his daughter, well, thanks a lot for spending all this time with me, but who are you? And so that first scene in the play...
Was inspired by
the real... occurrence in Kevin's life with his dad and his sister. And he sat and told me that on the air. Now, you know, my mother has dementia.
Right,
and he told me that, and several of us in the newsroom, as with thousands and thousands, millions of Americans are facing the same thing. He sat and told us that in the studio, and I just thought, I'm not going to cry. I'm just looking at Kevin. I'm feeling so much. Like, I cannot believe that's how personal this is, but Kevin is, and I think maybe a lot of guys handle, you know, things differently than women do, you know, less emotional maybe, outwardly so.
Sure.
Outwardly so. But the play is based on a real event that Kevin's family endured. And so it just makes it all the more poignant to me. And I'm playing a nun who's helping the family.
I'm just a pot dealer from Colorado.
It's just hilarious.
I own a dispensary in Colorado with my wife, Jane Duker.
There's so much that's so good about this, like, you know, keeping secrets from each other. That's always a good part of Kevin's plays. There's always a secret of some kind. There's always confusion of some kind.
Are you talking about the play itself or at the rehearsal?
plenty
of confusion this morning. Well, I didn't know that was the inspiration, but I don't want to leave people with the impression that the show is a big downer because obviously,
no,
even though
hilarious.
That might have been part of the inspiration, it is pretty funny. And, you know, the thing about the way he writes those is a lot of times you could certainly read your script and say, well, he's going to laugh at that. And then people laugh. He knows his audience. He knows how to do
this. He absolutely knows. And I can, he's writing us. And there might be, I might get into like March or April and things may happen in the newsroom. And
he's taking notes.
It honestly crosses my mind.
Yeah. Like, well, how did I become a pot dealer from Colorado?
Well, I think the play for you and Jane clearly is that he's taking your politics and flipping it.
Yes, he is.
He's totally taking.
I'm not going to say anything else.
That's it. I could ruin
more things. That's all I'll say about the character. But you are right about that. It's a little bit more nuanced than just being the owner of a dispensary store in Colorado, who, in reality, apparently is trying to convince his family that he fixes fax machines.
And is down on his luck.
Yes.
Right, which you are clearly so not. I'm sure you have on $300 shoes right now.
Oh, my God, really? Seriously, you want to go there? All right, that's enough. We're moving on here. But it should be fun tonight, and all starts at 7 o'clock.
And I will say to anyone whose family is dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's, and I've worked a lot with the association here in Missouri, there is a lot of humor in all of the sadness of addressing a family member who's becoming forgetful, maybe even argumentative or getting lost or whatever. I mean, there is a lot of humor. Yeah. Families still find a lot to laugh about. You're going to enjoy this tonight. You're going to identify with it, and you're going to laugh right along with us.
Well, and you know, we've talked about this before. That is a tough subject, and it's a tough subject for me, even though I don't have anyone that's close to me that's experiencing that.
Because
I'm so afraid of it. I mean, definitely afraid of it, not only for myself, but for other people. And I always point back to that documentary. You know, Glenn Campbell died last year.
Yes.
And the Glenn Campbell documentary, I'll Be Me, is fantastic.
Yes.
I would suggest watching it perhaps alone, because you're going to cry and you're going to get emotional. And for anyone who maybe has connections to dementia and Alzheimer's, I would recommend it, even if you don't. The good news is, as I was told by, darn it, I can't remember the director's name. He did Walk the Line as well, and I'm drawing a blank. But he said at the time, I think I told you this, mm-hmm. that the good news is, and he's working on another follow-up project that really shows some promising research to attack these things with the brain in the future. So I think the hope would be, maybe Carol, you and I are a little bit too young for this, but
right,
if we start looking
children.
At our kids, there's some solutions in the future. So that would be some good news. And he was really, really encouraging about that. So I can't wait to see how that turns
out. Listen, be encouraged and laugh with us tonight. Because it's just going to be hilarious.
Carol Daniel.
Mark the pot dealer.
I may or may not have a little bit of a costume involved, too.
Me too.
Yeah, oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I told him, I said, there's a hat of some kind. And I said, I have a big head and a lot of hair. So let's
be a big hat. Yeah, I haven't tried mine on yet, but I look forward to it.
Thanks,
those
Kevin.
People there. Yeah,
thank you, Kevin Colleen.
Working on it real hard right now. And we'll get, of course, the full report tomorrow afternoon here.
Live
on
tonight.
KMOX. Live tonight on the radio station. Let's see what I was going to get into here, because I really want to do. You know, this was a story. I think this story aired. I'd have to check that. The 60-minute story on opioids may have aired early in the year, but it really was interesting last night. And I don't know that I have time for that right now, but I want to spend some time on it tomorrow. So, Dave, remind me, if I don't get to it this hour, we're gonna hit it tomorrow, because it was a pretty important story. And it's obviously something that is being experienced all over this area and all over Missouri and the rest of the country as well. How about this story from North Ridgeville, Ohio? Oh, and Dr. Mark Siegel, chief medical correspondent, Fox News, coming on. He's a physician in New York. He's going to talk about the Obamacare ruling and what it really means and what the possibilities are. Coming up here in just a couple of minutes. All right, North Ridgeville, Ohio. A police officer in Cleveland, in that suburb, posted a message on social media after ticketing an 18-year-old for driving 100 miles per hour in a 65-mile-per-hour zone. The officer wrote on Facebook Sunday, he didn't feel bad about writing the ticket because the teen needs to slow down before causing a fatal crash. The officer says that the reckless teen driver seemed like a really nice kid who made a bad decision. Now, that was a post that was shared 50,000 times. And here's what he said. All right. This is important for parents out there. Something that goes viral that has some meaning. We don't have that very often with social media. To the 18-year-old kid I stopped on SR-10. You're welcome. I'd like to believe that you were minutes away from creating an unspeakable Christmas tragedy when I stopped you. If not only killing yourself, you were well on your way to killing some innocent person who was minding their own business, doing nothing else wrong but being in front of you. You said you didn't realize how fast you were going. That's a lie. I mean, let's be honest. When you're going 100 miles an hour, you know it. And that's what he said. He said, you may not realize when you're doing 45 and a 35, but you're fully aware of every mile per hour at 100. You realize it with every bump you hit. You realize it as you pass cars so fast that the wind moves your car. You realize it every time you drift over the line. And when you move the wheel of the car, it reacts a lot quicker than you used to. You absolutely realize it. I will tell you this. Occasionally, I get my car up a little bit faster than I anticipate. And I notice that we're in the mid-80s. And when I say we're, I mean I. And that's where I start to feel it, which means I should back off. And I do. And I don't try to drive 85, but every once in a while, if I'm passing or something like that, I think it gets a little bit too high. I have a fast car, too. He says, you were scared when I stopped you. You were visibly shaking and breathing hard. Unfortunately, you were scared 1 minute too late and for the wrong reason. You should have been scared that you were trying to kill yourself. I know you're invincible. I know that you can't even fathom your own death. The officer wrote, I can tell you dozens of stories of dead and broken 18-year-old bodies that have pulled from cars. Broken bodies that I found in front yards after crashes. Unrecognizable bodies. They thought they were invincible too. They weren't. They were gone, so they missed the part when I had to tell their parents that they were dead. Part of your soul disappears every time you have to tell parents that their kid is dead. I don't know your parents, but I know them. I know that when you leave every day, they say, be careful, drive safe. Those aren't just words. That is the very last act of them pleading with you to come home safe. When they get a knock on the door, it's not good afternoon, ma'am. Your 18-year-old son just had a massive heart attack. It's, can we sit down? Your son has been involved in a very serious crash. I'm so sorry. He's died. When you leave the house, they know that far and away the best chance you have of dying that day is in that car, which really is true when you think about it. That's me, my words there. He wrote, sometimes you're the innocent person hit by someone with no regard for anyone else, and sometimes you're in the car and you're the one with no regard for anyone else. Today, you were the latter. The officer said, you seemed like a really nice kid who made a bad decision. I don't feel bad about this ticket at all. In fact, I'm proud of it. I hope you're paying it off for months, and with every payment, you think about how it wasn't worth it. I hope you slow down. I hope that when your mom tells you to drive safe, you make a promise to her and yourself that you will. I hope you can envision me sitting in your kitchen telling your screaming mother that you've been killed. Slow down, please. You're not invincible. I promise. And I do think that, you know, 18, 20-year-old, 22-year-old kids, when we're younger, we feel like we're invincible. We don't think there's going to be an effect on anyone else, but there is. And this guy in the Cleveland suburb of North Ridgeville, Ohio, I think punctuated that. That would be an important message. It's gone viral on Facebook. You can Google that. I think you can find it easily. Share that with your kids. Maybe not wrap it up for a message on Christmas morning, but certainly pass it along to them because it is an important message. 317, Dr. Mark Siegel coming up. Also, Derek Gould from the Post-Dispatch. Great piece about Dexter Fowler yesterday and some of the struggles he had mentally and physically and emotionally this past season. Derek's going to join me at 3:30.
Miss an interesting interview Mark Reardon had? You can always hear it again. Mark's podcasts are always online at KMOX.com.
City sidewalks, busy sidewalks, dressed in holiday style.
Well, I had to tell my daughter this morning that Santa was coming a week from tonight, and she's still got time to get off that naughty list. A bit of a challenge in the Reardon household. We actually saw Santa having breakfast on Saturday morning over at Schneinhorst. We were there to see Andrew finally get Poptions and get some Monkey Nuts, which may now be gone. Monkey Nuts, my favorite flavor of Poptions. Poptions closing down next week after Christmas, the 28th, the last day, and fantastic supporter of not only my show here, but also my movie segment on Friday afternoons, and went in to say hi, and Santa was having breakfast. He was eating some pancakes, and we got to kind of sneak in and say hi to him, but Alexa was a little afraid. Well, yeah, a week from today, Santa comes, and just as a note on this week, I'll be gone on Thursday and Friday, on Monday and Tuesday of next week, but back for some really fun best of shows Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I haven't decided if we're going to do a Reardon Roundtable during Christmas week, but stay tuned for that. All right, so we spent a little time earlier this afternoon with Senator Roy Blunt on the issue of the Obamacare ruling. I always like to go to Mark Siegel, Fox News chief medical correspondent, for him to break things down because he does a great job. Dr. Siegel in New York City, how are you?
Great to be on with you. How you doing?
I'm good. So I sense that whenever something like this happens, there's a fair amount of confusion. So what did the judge do and what does it mean? There's a simple question just to get us started.
Well, basically, let me explain why this happened, Mark. It happened because when Obamacare was last before the Supreme Court, John Roberts made a decision, and he made it a 5-4 by saying, look, the individual mandate as a penalty is unconstitutional, but if I make it a tax penalty, then Congress has the right to levy taxes. So therefore, it's constitutional. So he did a little jury rigging of the thing, no pun intended, and let it to go pass, which surprised people because Roberts supposed to be a conservative judge, and that was more like what something you might expect a liberal judge to do. That's the background on this.
Right.
Now, Judge O'Connor is saying, well, wait a minute. The tax is gone. I mean, Congress just got rid of the tax, but they left the mandate in, which leaves it dangling as a penalty rather than a tax, which is unconstitutional. That's what's happening now. My prediction is, though, that as this goes on through the appeal process and perhaps gets to the Supreme Court, I don't expect the Supreme Court to declare the entire law unconstitutional because they have a history of basing things on statutes, and there's a concept called severability where they can say, you know, it's constitutional or these particular statutes are constitutional. And Justice Kavanaugh, who just got added to the Supreme Court, has a history of doing that. Now, that's the non-medical piece. Here's the medical piece. Mark, the medical piece is that Obamacare doesn't work in its current form. Why? Because the whole idea was, let's use the individual mandate to funnel people into a system where there are services they may not need that they have to pay for, where they get a sense of access to actual health care, but the deductibles are in the way of that, and the average deductible this year is about $4,000 per person, which is huge. So you got this policy, you have a narrow network of doctors and hospitals to go to, and you get the deductible in the way of actual care. So it doesn't work for doctors, it doesn't work for hospitals, and it doesn't work for patients. And you know how I know that's true? Because 6.5 million people last year took the tax penalty, and they said this ain't working. So the whole idea of forcing people into this system didn't work. I'm glad the individual mandate is essentially gone.
So you have, well, look, Stephen Miller was on Face the Nation. You have other Republicans saying that clearly this is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court will rule that way. If you're right and the Supreme Court does not rule it unconstitutional, what are we left with? We're still left with the Affordable Care Act, right?
Well, I'm not a crystal ball guy. Maybe Stephen Miller's right. It doesn't matter to me that much whether they strike it down, because I'll tell you what we're going to be left with either way. We're going to be left with the need to cover people with pre-existing conditions,
right?
Because 70% of Americans want that. A majority of Americans like the Medicaid expansion, especially in rural areas, including a lot of red states. We're going to be left with the Medicaid expansion. What we're also going to need, and we're also already starting to see, is the introduction of skinnier plans, temporary skinnier plans, association plans. We got to raise health savings accounts, make them more prominent and usable, so that patients have an opportunity to make more choices, and their prices are transparent. There will be more and more generic drugs approved. There'll be more options available. In the end of the game, I'd like to see everybody insured, but I think it was way wrong to force, I call it a Ponzi scheme, to force healthy young people to be paying for older sick people when you consider that 5% of America is using 50% of the health care.
Yeah.
That just doesn't work.
No.
Put it another way. I don't think people need to have Ferrari or Cadillac insurance. I think if you offer, as a minimum, Chevy insurance, you're going to get more people in the insurance pool. The idea of forcing everybody to pay high-priced insurance with high deductibles that make it unusable never worked.
Dr. Mark Siegel is my guest, so let's go back to pre-existing conditions. This became a big issue in our U.S. Senate race between Claire McCaskill, who lost that race, and Josh Hawley, who was signed on to this lawsuit, one of the states, Missouri, with the Republican governors that went before Judge Reed O'Connor. But my position has been, to a certain extent, that some of the stuff about pre-existing conditions is a red herring from this perspective. I think it scares people who have insurance right now who might not be on the Obamacare exchanges, because if you have insurance, if you don't gap that insurance, there's already a law that says you'll be covered by pre-existing conditions. So we're talking about the people who may or may not be in the exchange, or if they drop off and they get back on. Those are the people we're talking about, right?
Yeah, but again, if Obamacare survives, you're going to see them have the option of buying those Obamacare policies that are heavily subsidized. If Obamacare doesn't survive, the Republicans are going to be under pressure to put together a plan that includes coverage of pre-existing conditions, however they are subsidized, whether there are high-risk pools, which have never been funded properly in the past. However they are subsidized, the idea of relaxing guarantee and community rating so that you get to be covered regardless of your pre-existing condition. We're talking about 133 million Americans that have some pre-existing condition. That idea is very popular among Americans, and we're going to have to do something to cover that. Unfortunately, we're dealing at a time of great innovation when our health solutions are becoming personalized, and any universal health insurance struggles to cover the treatments of the future, which is one of the main reasons I and others are against Medicare for All or any kind of single-payer system. It's just not going to help us take care of people with our exciting new immunotherapies and genetic treatments.
The Republicans, every time I talk to a Republican about this with pre-existing conditions, they say, and I guess I feel like, look, of course, they're not going to allow that to move forward without coverage for pre-existing conditions. But the Democrats say, look, they, you know, we can't trust them. They don't have a plan. And any of the plans that they have put forward really don't achieve what we want when it comes to pre-existing conditions. But again, I still think that that issue is used as a scare tactic.
Yeah, it's saber-rattling because the reality is things have changed. If they have to rewrite the law, they got to get it through the House, right? And Democrats control the House.
That's right.
There would have to be some bipartisanship here. And I'm wondering if the Democrats are willing to compromise. They didn't show any willingness to compromise back in 2008 and 9, did they?
No.
You know, that's why this mess occurred. President Obama made a deal with the insurance companies rather than with the Republicans. And that was a big mistake, and that's why we're in such trouble. And by the way, the law is unconstitutional. But the problem is that there's a precedent already where it's been in place. I'm just telling you my prediction. I'm not telling you that I agree with it. There's a precedent where the law has been in place for almost 5 years now. And on top of that, the Supreme Court has a habit of going with severability. So I'm not predicting that this will be declared unconstitutional. I think it is unconstitutional,
yeah, right.
By the way.
Well,
but I don't think it's where it's going to go.
We'll see what the justices do, and appreciate your insight as always, because I think you help break this down in a very easily understandable way, which is why I like having you on the show, Dr. Mark Siegel. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Great to be on with you, Mark.
And just to clarify, you know, it has to go through the circuit court process, so it's not exactly heading to the Supreme Court necessarily or right away. So I think he did a pretty good job of breaking it down there, and his opinion is a little different from what you're hearing from the White House, which is not unusual these days. It's 3:30. Derek Gould to talk about Dexter Fowler. Did a great piece on Dex yesterday. You might have seen it in the Sunday Post-Dispatch. Derek's just around the corner. Audio cut of the day before the end of the hour. Right into Total Information PM. We have the KMOX Holiday Radio Show tonight starting at 7 o'clock. Great piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch yesterday by Cardinals beat writer and comic book movie aficionado Derek Gould, who joins me this afternoon, maybe to talk about Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse or Dexter Fowler. We're not sure. How are you, Derek?
I am fine. Mark, can I tell you that on my bucket list is to someday be in that holiday program? Someday. Someday.
Wow. We might be able to. Usually it's only people who are on the radio station on a regular basis, not like once a week like Johnny Rabbit or, no, I'm sorry, I'm kidding. But yeah, I could probably work that out for you. We can maybe see if we get that done.
When I worked at the station, it didn't happen. So fingers crossed, maybe someday.
Did you see on the movie front, did you see the Spider-Man movie yet?
I did, yeah. I got back from Vegas and saw it.
I haven't seen it yet. I've heard it's excellent.
The story is excellent. The whole thing is really well done, and it is a gymnastic feat of storytelling because it introduces a very compelling Spider-Man, which maybe many people don't know about, but they should from the comic books, and then also introduces four other new Spider-Men, all of whom have a backstory in the comics that is good, and they do a really good job with it. The animation can be overwhelming at times, and it's genius in how it's kind of a patchwork of different styles. So you'll have your eyes tested. It's kaleidoscopic at times, but it's a beautiful movie and well told.
Awesome. Well, I'm really looking forward to see it. I missed the screening about a week and a half ago. All right, so last week I remember when I was here and Chris Raby was out there with you in Vegas, you know, for the winter meetings, I remember seeing Jennifer Langlosh tweet, in fact, I think I retweeted it, that Cardinals upper management types were going to be going to Dexter Fowler's place for dinner. Now, were you at that, when you did this interview, was that a separate event or were you at that dinner with all those guys?
Huh, right.
Well, I mean, I didn't know if you were if they gave you a little access, because you obviously had some pretty good access here.
I was there the next day.
Okay.
I met with Fowler at his house the next day.
Now, the thing that jumps out here is when he talks about how he was depressed. He said, I was depressed. That's what I was. I got mad and I let it get to me. Are we talking a clinical depression or just mentally kind of down in the dumps? Because there's a difference there.
There's a difference, yeah. And there's also, you know, I have to be at a case where what is he willing to share?
Sure.
And he was willing to share his feelings, how he felt them, and I tried to do my part to quote him saying that, but then also describe some of the things that he offered aside, and then the treatment that he sought and who was an important part of that. So his description of it was, you know, that he had depression and he was depressed and that this went far deeper than just like you described, yeah. He wasn't Eeyore, you know, he had something that he had a hole that he could not climb out of without a ladder that somebody else had to offer him. And I was very careful in the story to describe how it was feelings of depressions and symptoms of depression, because I know that there's a difference.
Yeah.
But I don't think you should take lightly his description, nor should, you know, and like I said, I wanted to give him the respect to what are you offering, because this is a personal challenge for him. This is a personal story. It's also a personal admission. So it's what length are you willing to tell me about, and how would you describe it? I thought that was important.
I think it's important too. And, you know, I mentioned this, I was talking about it with some friends over the weekend, and I said at the beginning of the show, I think we all forget, fans forget, even folks who write and, you know, talk about athletes and professional athletes, that, you know, they're living their lives too, and they go through things like mental illness and divorces and challenges with health and, you know, kids who are sick, all these things that we all experience that can be really, really difficult to go through every day with, let alone do your job. So mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it's good to kind of take a pause and realize that. Now, you asked some questions. You know, I guess the one of the quotes in here was about how he truly loves baseball. And then the question was, did he lose the love of baseball in 2018? There was a bit of a pause there, wasn't there?
Yeah. I had recorded the interview so I could go back and count the pause. And I mean, it was 5 seconds long. And, you know, I mean, he didn't take that pause to do anything but think about the next answer. And then he tried to make it very clear to me that the game didn't lose his fondness for the game, but he lost his fondness for everything that was around the game. And that was tricky. You know, like the being at the ballpark, being on the field, being doing all these things just didn't have the same resonance with him. And that bothered him.
Well, you know, if he was in some cloud of depression, I think that a lot of people could understand that. So, look, Derek, we all want this team to be better because we seek entertainment and fulfillment in our lives because of the Cardinals. And it's one of those great institutions in all of sports. And it's important to folks who live here in St. Louis. But it's very easy for fans or people on the radio or sports columnists to take jabs at guys like Dexter Fowler because he hasn't performed in the way that we certainly would like to. And I don't think, you know, if you read the piece, he hasn't performed to his expectations at all. But I've said this the last couple of weeks, and I think we're seeing this come to fruition with upper management, that I don't want to give up on the guy because I think he has too much talent. And I thought that way before I read your piece. After reading the piece, I certainly feel that way even more.
Yeah, I mean, and I think he, you know, part of the thing that he shared with me, and maybe his wife, Aaliyah, put best, was that, you know, he has talked a lot about, like, okay, look, I get it. I mean, he has, what, retreated completely from Twitter because of the vulgarities and awfulness thrown at him.
Can't blame him.
Yeah.
Right.
And so he knows that there is some repair to be done with even the fans that are loyal and fond of him and want him to do well. And he's talked a lot about that. He talked in generalities with me. But his wife later told me that he has been more specific, obviously, with her, where he said, look, I get it. I have to have a better relationship, but I have to earn it. And I want that opportunity. And that's also a sentiment that he shared with Mike Schilt, the manager, was this notion that, look, it's good that the Cardinals are coming out there and they're committed to him and they're telling him that they're behind him and they don't have any interest in trying to, you know, move him. The thought of a trade never came up because they're like, look, you're part of us. Mm-hmm. We want you to be a big part of this. And he realized, like, look, it's good to get that commitment from them, but having received it, it's also a shared commitment. Now what do I do?
So, Derek Gould from the Post-Dispatch with me this afternoon. How is, let me Two-part question here. How is his physical health, considering he went out with the foot injury, and how does Barry Bonds play into all of this?
So, wow.
well, so I wanted to get the Barry Bonds stuff in because that's kind of important, yeah. I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. So physical health, good. Had to have an extra 6 weeks. I think people who were following the team closely during the season will know that Fowler was around the team late in the year, and he was out of his boot, and he was in the dugout and all that stuff and able to move around. Well, he was back in the boot after seeing a specialist. So that's a setback of some sort. He had to It's a setback. So he had to have another 6 weeks in the boot to repair the fractured left foot. He did that, then had another month in the metal plate, could move around, can do weightlifting, can do all the things, but not strenuous running stuff. Was able to avoid losing or having muscles atrophy. So that meant that a week and a half ago when he got cleared for baseball activities, he was already in good condition to ramp those up. And he has been. He's been hitting, running, is going to start throwing, fielding, stuff like that as well in the coming weeks. Where Barry Bonds fits into this? Well, Barry Bonds is an interesting presence for the Cardinals, no doubt, because two of the Cardinals outfielders who they need good years from, Ozuna and Fowler, count Barry Bonds as their hitting mentor. And in Fowler's case, it's something more than that. He said that, you know, he looks at him as a role model. Fowler told me that Barry is protective of Dexter as he is of his sons. And this relationship starts from, you know, after 2013, they were put in touch with each other. Fowler wanted to become a better hitter from the left side. He's a switch hitter. And he thought, how can I be a better hitter from the left side? I know, I'll go out talk to one of the greatest left-handed hitters of all time.
But he didn't really know him at the time. In fact, had never even met him in person, right?
Never met him in person. Only had one connection with him, and that was Glenn Allen Hill. And all this was not in the story, so this is added detail. But so reached out to him, said, I want to come learn from you, will you? And he got a response from Barry Bonds that was basically all these workouts that had nothing to do with hitting. And I told Fowler, I go, man, he Mr. Miyagi'd you.
Right.
He was like wax on, wax off. He did all this stuff. And Fowler was convinced that he told him to do all this stuff so that he would quit before he even got started. And he said, well, that's not going to happen. So he didn't. He lived in the Salt Lake City area at the time, and it was snowing and, you know, the weather that they get there near the mountains. And he would go out and run. He would go out and do the stadium stairs. He would go out and do everything that Bonds told him that he had to do to be physically ready to learn how to hit. And then he showed up and he met Barry Bonds for the first time and said, here I am. I did all those things. And Bonds went, oh, wait, really? What? Okay. And so then he said, all right, well, let's work. And they've been working ever since. That was 2013. They've been working ever since. Some of the early work that they did was on physical conditioning to hit. Bonds would take him out running in the sands there outside of San Francisco. Barry Bonds, people may not know this, is a huge, I mean, of all the things we know about Barry Bonds, right? It seems like we know everything. But he's a huge bicycling fan and a huge cyclist. So you guys would get along.
I know.
Right?
I got to talk cycling with him sometime. That's great.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Tried to drag Fowler into it. Fowler preferred the other workout. Now it's basically they do spend a lot of time hitting. He'll spend a couple weeks with him. And sometimes Bonds comes to Fowler's home and lives with them and will work directly with him.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's a very fascinating relationship.
Yeah, that is interesting. Well, unfortunately, I'm out of time, and I wanted to talk karaoke because that's something else Dexter Fowler is apparently good at. And the other thing that you pointed out, I think this is really important, shows a commitment to the fans, too. Originally, he was not supposed to be at the winter warm-up. There was a wedding, and he told the Cardinals he's coming, right, in a few weeks?
Yeah. We talked on Thursday night. I talked to him about that on Friday and Saturday. He and his family made the decision to notify the team that he would be here, and he is here. They put tickets on sale today for him.
That's awesome. Derek Gould, thank you so much. Really interesting piece. Great insight into Dexter Fowler. And I'm excited because, look, we talk about all these pieces of the puzzle, and it's almost like we forget about that contribution that is possible, potential from Dexter Fowler, and I'm certainly rooting for him now more than ever. Derek, have a great Christmas season and holiday, and we'll talk to you and see you soon. And I'll lobby for your slot in the KMOX Holiday Radio Show.
Someday.
Someday.
Just someday.
You keep dreaming, buddy.
Yeah, I know. I just want to share a stage with you, Mark. That's all.
Yeah, well, it's not that big of a deal. See you. Derek Gould with us this afternoon on KMOX.
Stand by. Playback ready. Now, the audio cut of the day.
And here's what we have for you. George Stephanopoulos with Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani trying to explain the hush payments from President Trump. Wasn't president then. Candidate Trump to porn stars and others.
In the case of Rio Hunter, right? The payment of $1.1 million was intended to shut her up and it was intended to avoid embarrassment with his wife and with his children. Now, which is worse?
Yeah, but what
the campaign
did,
problem with the wife and the children.
But what you did, that's that case. Let's talk about the president's case.
Same thing.
Didn't it? No, it's not the same thing.
Yes, it is.
In this case, you have contemporaneous witnesses saying it was for the campaign. You have a statement of fact saying the president met, Donald Trump met with David Pecker.
And I can produce an enormous number of that say the president was very concerned about how this was going to affect his children, his marriage, not just this one, but similar. All those women came forward at that point in time, that tape with Billy Bush and all of that. It's all part of the same thing. And I know what he was concerned about, and I can produce 20 witnesses to tell you what he was concerned about.
2 weeks before the campaign.
You're damn right. And he was concerned about all of it.
Did he ever make any payments like that in the past?
Nobody else asked for payments. Oh, in the past, I can't speak to. I wasn't his lawyer in the past. But at that point, these were the only two that were asking for money. And the amount of money is consistent with harassment, not truth. I have been involved in cases like this. When it's true and you have the kind of money that the president had, it's a $1 million settlement. When it's not true, when it's a harassment settlement, and it's not true, you give them $130,000, $150,000. They went away for so little money that it indicates their case was very, very weak. And look, Stormy Daniels now has to pay the president legal fees.
That's George Stephanopoulos with Rudy yesterday. Your audio cut of the day on KMOX. Total Information PM coming up.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.